Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. Where is the mind? Well, the mind is nowhere. I mean, there's not a place that you can say, this is where the mind is, the way you can say, this is where my brain is. But what we do know is that the brain is the medium for the mind. The brain is that through which we experience the mind. And the reason that we know that is things that happen to our brain affect our mind. I drink alcohol, a very physical substance. It has a very physical reaction on my blood, therefore a physical reaction on the connections in my brain. But my experience of my mind changes. Maybe I was feeling really stressed. Now I'm not so stressed. Maybe I was feeling more shy. Now I'm ready to dance with the world. So that which we do that's very physical, that we know impacts the mind, ranging from alcohol and drugs to brain injuries, to literal injuries that we know. People get shot in the brain, and we've got 100 years worth of neuroscience history of knowing, oh, a lesion in this part of the brain, oh, a stroke in that part of the brain, oh, here's what it does. So we know that the brain is the seat of how we experience the mind. Recently, someone very, very close to us passed away from Alzheimer's. And it was fascinating because as we watched her disintegrate, the brain disintegrate, and I know from my personal neurological background, where in the brain it is that Alzheimer's happens. I mean, we know it's the dendrites. We know it's the connections. We know exactly what's happening neurologically. We don't know why, but we know what is happening. And then what you get is a woman who used to be so loving and kind and generous. Now suddenly, angry, violent, hitting, not recognizing her own family members. And it actually really made me think, and this is now what I'm sharing with you is the outcome of a lot of personal introspection that I did, because I thought, God, you know, love feels so deep. You said, okay, I know my heart. Well, what's the heart? The heart is love, right? So now let me challenge that a little bit. With a little bit of degeneration of the dendrites in your brain, that which you identify as the deepest love, where does it go? How does that love disintegrate with some connections between brain cells? I mean, right? Isn't our love deeper than that? Love lives here, not in my dendrites. I mean, am I that shallow? And what I've realized in thinking and actually talking to a lot of people over the years, because it really made me start to think she was the first person I knew so closely to have this sort of illness. And with a background in neurology, I was fascinated by what is happening. Okay, I understand she can't remember things. But why does our love go? Where does our peace go? Where does our happiness go? Does that really just exist in our dendrites? And what I've realized is it doesn't. No, of course, it's much deeper than that. And yet the brain is the medium for the experience of that. The same way the eyes are the medium for the experience of sight. Sight does not exist in my eyes. But if you pull out my eyes, I no longer can see. Similarly, I could have perfect eyes, but you could damage the occipital lobe of my brain, I still could no longer see. Now, sight is still there. The people I was seeing were still there. The world is still there, even though it's become dark to me. Where did that exist? Where did they exist? Okay, so we know the mind is deeper than the brain, but the brain is actually the seat of that. The brain is the medium through which we experience it. Now, why doesn't it let me sit still? Why is it negative? Well, first of all, it's not always negative. The positive stuff is actually just as distracting as the negatives. It's more enjoyably distracting. We'd much rather take a daydream back to a beautiful moment in our life or into a fantasy of where we'd like to go. I mean, daydreaming is fun. But unfortunately, it is the opposite of meditation. And so while we may enjoy it, it's just as detrimental to being in the present as negativity. The mind tends to be negative, sadly, because we have such expectations. Children's minds are not negative. Children tend to be positive. They're happy, they're smiley. What makes them negative? They're hungry. They're tired. They've got a diaper full of poop. I mean, it's really basic stuff. Feed them, clean their diaper, and you've got a happy kid. Hold them, love them, you've got an extra happy kid. For us, what ends up happening is the mind starts to steal our happiness, and this is where it becomes negative, is as we grow, we develop this ego. And the ego is important because the ego distinguishes us from others. So the ego is the thing that when your mom says, ask before you take his truck, that's not yours. No, you can't have the cookies from your sister's plate. Those are hers. So we have to understand the distinction between mine and yours so that we can play nicely in the playground. But then the ego in that ends up, it takes that and it runs with it. So it begins with, her cookies, don't eat them. And it ends with, why does she get that? Why does she have this? Why does he get that? His truck is prettier than my truck. I want his red truck. I don't want my blue truck. And then we grow, and it gets bigger. She has this house. He has that car. She has this job. He has this wife. And it becomes everything. And that which we needed to develop to learn to play nicely in the playground has become our greatest enemy because it's always about you versus me, yours versus mine. Why is yours so much better than mine? Why do you get everything and I don't? Why do you have the shiny truck and I don't? You've got the cookies, I don't. And this is how And of course, what the ego then does is it decides that there's some problem in the world. Or it decides there's a problem with us, depending on how we've been raised. We end up with one of two pathologies. Either I'm the worst, I don't deserve anything, or I deserve it, but the world isn't giving it to me. In either case, it's negativity. And they're actually just, I mean, they're not so different. They're two sides that many of us flip back and forth with. So it's, I deserve it, I'm bitter, I'm angry, the world isn't giving it to me, things aren't fair, it's not right, it shouldn't be like this, what about me? Into, oh my God, I can't believe I'm thinking like this, I'm the worst, I'm never going to meditate, I'll never be spiritual, even God doesn't like me. And it goes like this. The other thing that the mind does is it judges. And again, this comes from our culture. It's how we're raised. It's how we're raised. It's how our parents raise us. They don't mean to do it. It's just, it's how they are. We're raised, we judge. This is pretty, this is ugly, this is nice, that's not nice. This is what good girls do, this is what bad girls do. This is what good boys do, bad boys. We're constantly labeling, constantly judging. Mommy's pretty little girl. Mommy's bad girl. Everything is judgment. Everything is labels. And so we develop this habit, this sanskar of labeling things. And we carry it into our world. I'm beautiful. I'm ugly. I'm successful. I'm a failure. I'm worthy. I'm not worthy. And this is the stuff that occupies the mind because there is no end. With 7 billion people on the planet, there is no end to the number of those with whom you can compare yourself. There is no end to the judgments you can pass. There is no end to where some are so much better off. And then, of course, the guilt, because that comes in, oh my God, but these people are so, I can't believe I'm feeling badly about myself. What do I have to feel badly about? Oh my God, look at these kids. And then the guilt. And with all of it, I'm everywhere except here. I'm everywhere except here. Because the truth is, right here, in this breath, in this moment, I'm okay. I'm enough. It's enough. This breath is enough. This presence is enough. And that actually scares the ego. And that's where when you start meditating, sadly, the ego actually amps up what it does. Because that experience of enoughness is the greatest enemy to the ego. The ego needs scarcity, competition, negativity, judgment to live. And so love, surrender, acceptance, enoughness are the enemies of the ego. And so the minute that you, I mean, those of us who've been on, you know, spiritual paths for a while, you know, you begin and the ego just is, you go another step, the ego, and you always know that you're actually just taking another step when suddenly you're like, oh my God, I thought you and I were done. And out of the blue, here comes this ego in a new form. It's always a new form because it's very clever. Takes you a moment to recognize it. You're like, but I thought we finished this thing. And it comes up every time we start to get deeper and deeper in our spiritual paths. Every time we start to surrender more, experience our own enoughness more. Because that's the stuff that shrivels the ego. Remember, the ego was created out of know your place, separation. So connection, oneness. This is what shrivels the ego. And so this is where you may not notice your wandering mind so much until you sit to meditate. And it's not that it's not wandering other times. It is. If you start to pay attention, you'll notice you're sitting, even now, many of our minds are wandering. Sit in a conversation with someone, your mind is wandering. But it tends to pick up an increased frenzy in your meditation. So it's not the mind that's the enemy. And it's not even the ego that's the enemy by any means. It's just they need to understand that they're not in charge. You want to solve a math problem? You need your mind. That's what the mind does. You need to figure something out, sort something out, difficulty, an issue. So much of that which we do in our work, we need our mind. We need to solve things, figure things out, be effective, be efficient. My intuitive heart has no idea how to make a spreadsheet. My mind knows how to do that. So we need it. But it's not supposed to be running the show. It's supposed to be a tool in our hands. And this is where meditation becomes so important. Is it enables us to get out of the clutches of the mind, the clutches of the ego, and to re-experience, I'm here. In a moment of not being run by my mind. And in this moment where I'm not being run by my mind, I'm enough. The moment is enough. And then we're able to string those moments together more and more and more and more.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the iOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on iOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. Really, anything that happens in meditation is right. As long as you're meditating, it's right. Music is energy. You know, sadly these days, so many of us think of music just as entertainment. Well, I like this type of music, or I like that type of music, or who's your favorite band, or, you know, this is danceable, that's not danceable. But Indian culture actually had such a deep, deep awareness of the science of sound. That it's the only religion in the world I know of that actually has an entire scripture, the Psalm Veda, dedicated to sound. And here's what's interesting about that, is it's not Indian sound, it's not Hindu sound, it's the science of sound. Many years ago, I had the wonderful opportunity to be in Venice, Italy. And from Venice, we went to a big yoga program that was being held in Assisi. And in Assisi, we went to this very, very ancient cathedral of St. Francis. And there was a program of Gregorian chanting, which is the ancient and sacred chanting. And Pooja Swamiji was there, and this other very, very renowned saint who has since passed away, unfortunately, was also there. And the Gregorian chanting went on for quite some time. And after it ended, and the rest of us were just thinking, oh, this is so beautiful, oh, this is so beautiful. And when it ended, Pooja Swamiji and this other Swamiji, also, as I said, very renowned, very learned, the two of them looked at each other and simultaneously they said, it's the Samved. That the sound of that which we were hearing in a cathedral in Assisi was the sound of the Samved. And that in a way that sounds much more amazing and miraculous than it really should, because these things actually should be the normal, but nonetheless, tragically, they're not in our lives the normal, so it seems really amazing, that deeply spiritual people living in different places, worshiping God by different names in different forms in different ways, but deeply connected to the divine, having deep meditative practices, connected to the same truth. And that that truth came through them in a very similar way. And so in Italy, we end up with Gregorian chants in the church lineage, and in India we end up with the Samved and the Hindu lineage. But that truth of the science of sound was so much the same that even though neither of them had ever heard Gregorian chanting, immediately they recognized, this is our Samved. Words are different. Tune is the same. And the last point I just wanted to mention on that, since Anandara so beautifully brought us onto this topic of sound, is whatever we're doing, whether we're singing, whether we're making music with our hands, or whether we're speaking, we're doing something that creates sound. We may think, oh, I just said that. It was only a joke. I didn't mean it. Or we yell. We think, well, I didn't mean to yell. I was just, you know, whatever. And what we don't realize is the impact of that. Yeah, we know the emotional impact. We know what it feels like to be yelled at. But what we don't think about is on a physiological level. Sound is actually energy waves. I mean, that's how it works. It's not that I've got some uncanny special ability to know from your lips what you're saying. I mean, some people can read lips, most of us can't. The way that I know what you're saying is it comes out of your mouth, creates waves, that goes into my ear, tells my brain what you're saying, and whether it's a very low frequency sound, which is going to have waves that look like this. Or a very high frequency sound, it's going to have waves that look like this. Well, the way that you know that is because of the way that those waves vibrate differently in your ear. And that creates not just an understanding of words, but it creates an energetic impact. And this is really the power that sound has. And whether it's the sound that comes out of our mouth, I mean, people do this all the time kind of jokingly, but it actually is science. You take a dog and you say to it, "Oh, you stupid, stupid, ugly thing." And it's going to wag its tail and, you know, come up and rub itself against you because it thinks that you're criticizing it. And, I mean, it thinks that you're loving it. And you could say to it, "I love you." And it's going to, you know, whimper. And because what it's picking up on is the sound. It's not the words. So the tone of being angry, regardless of whether with that tone you're saying "I love you" or you're saying "bad dog," is going to make the dog whimper. And the tone of "I love you," even if you're saying, "Oh, you're the ugliest, stupidest thing, I'm going to, you know, starve you for 3 days," it's going to wag its tail and rub up against you because it picks up on the energy. And so I just wanted to mention this because I'm listening to the sound. It always touches all of us so deeply, and I feel like it's so important to understand, particularly for those of us from the West, the real power that sound has. It's not just "I like this" or "I like that," but how can we use sound, music, and also the sound of our own voice to actually change the energetic waves in the world around us.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Alec Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with inspiration and transformation. The perspective of a non-renunciant, a householder who's on a spiritual path, is initiation or diksha by a guru important or necessary? So if we're not looking to take sannyas, if we're not looking to renounce everything, how important is the initiation by the guru? The initiation by the guru has nothing to do with whether we're going to take a vow of renunciation. A guru is one who removes darkness and brings light. That's what the word guru means. Gu is the darkness, ru is the remover of the darkness. So the guru is the one who removes the darkness and brings the light. That's the role of the guru. The guru is not someone who touches you on the head or waves a magic wand and turns you from a householder into a renunciant. The guru's role is to bring light to whatever dharma you're living, to whatever role you have in your life, to whatever path you are on. So it's not just that the guru's initiation is for renunciants. Everybody needs light. Those of us in orange robes who have taken vows of renunciation need it. Those who have not taken vows need it. All along the way, whatever role we may be in, whatever we're doing, the grace of the guru is crucial. And here's why. God is there. God is there for all of us, of course. The guru does not create God or bring God. It's not like the guru, you know, sort of lassos the moon and like that lassos God and, you know, brings God to you. But we all know that God is there. But it's very difficult for us to live like that. It's very difficult for us to live in our light. And the reason for that is that we're so over-identified with the roles we play. We're so over-identified with the body, with its history, with its personality, with everything it's doing, with all of its feelings. We're so identified with that. I am angry, really. I am angry. I am sad. I am this. I am that. And we believe it so deeply that that's who I am. Well, that's darkness. It's not evil darkness. It's just ignorant darkness. It's the darkness of ignorance that all of us need to be free of. It's the ignorance that says, I am what I'm feeling. Rather than just recognizing it as patterns that are going on in my head due to habits, due to sanskaras, due to experiences, due to my subconscious. It's not you. But it's difficult for us to live like that. And what the guru does is the guru comes in and shines a light for us so we can actually see the self. The guru's not going to do the work for you. Many people have that impression of a guru, of if I just find the right guru. Oh, if I still have to work, forget it, I've got the wrong guru. I need a new guru, a new mantra, a new teaching, a new course to get a certificate in. If I just find the right one, I won't be so plagued. I won't have so many troubles. It won't be so painful in my life. The guru will just do the work for me. The guru will turn my darkness to light automatically. Well, it's not exactly like that. It's not like, you know, I don't know if they have them here, but in America, they have these car washes where you can actually sit in your car while your car goes through a car wash. And first all the sudsy water comes and then the machines with the sponges come and they scrub that car while you're sitting inside it. And the guru's not like that. It's not like you get to just sit there in the car and watch the guru scrub you clean and bring light into all your darkness and do all of the work for you. The guru shines the light, showing you the truth. Here is who you are. Here is the truth. Here is the path. You're lost in the jungle of your own mind. You have no way out. The guru has the light, shines it. Here's the path. But you've got to walk it. The guru's not going to walk it for you. So the guru removes the darkness, shows us the light, brings the light. But we have to walk it. We have to keep our eyes open. The light may be very strong here, but if my eyes are closed, or I've got one of those like eye masks on, doesn't matter how bright it is. I have to take off the eye mask. I have to open my eyes. Most of us sort of expect that if we just find the right guru or the right mantra or in some cases the right husband or wife. For some of us, the right job. I mean, it's not that in all of our minds we're set that it has to be the guru who's going to fix us. For some of us, it's if I find the right person to marry, if I get the right job, that it's just going to come. And despite my eye mask, despite my closed eyes, it's just going to flood me with light. No. The guru brings the light, but I've got to open my eyes. I've got to take off that eye mask. I've got to walk the path. And so whether we are a householder, meaning somebody who's married with children in the workforce, or whether we're a renunciant, or whether we're any pieces of those, we all need the light. We're all lost in the darkness of our minds. We're all lost in the jungles of our own minds, the jungles of the stuff that goes on in our minds that is actually a far denser jungle than any jungle you could actually be lost in on earth. And the guru shines the light for us. But it doesn't always feel good. You know, if you imagine that you were a lump of clay on a potter's wheel, and the potter were going to turn you into something. Well, what does the potter do? Every time the wheel goes around, the potter hits it. It's how the potter makes the cups and bowls and whatever it makes. It's going to whack that lump of clay every time it spins around. And then it's going to take it, and it's going to stick it in the fire. Right? Because anybody who's ever done ceramics knows it doesn't matter how good your bowl or cup is, until you stick it into that kiln, it's not done. So the guru's going to hit you in an effort to mold you. And then just when you think the spinning is stopped, the dizziness is wearing off, then you get thrown in the fire. But when you come out, that lump of clay has actually been turned into art. But if you jump off the potter's wheel, or you refuse to go into the fire, doesn't matter how brilliant the potter is, doesn't matter how amazing the artist is, if you won't sit on that potter's wheel and you won't allow yourself to get thrown in the fire, they cannot make art with you. And this is the same with the guru. So the light gets shown, we get beaten into shape, we get thrown in the fire. But along the way, we start to realize, wow, and all this time I thought I was just a lump of clay. Huh, wow, now look at me. Somewhere along the way, art has been made. And we know I didn't do it. I was just the lump of clay. And it was the grace of the guru. It was the grace of the artist who turned that lump of clay into art. So when we find a guru, and if you haven't found one, don't worry. It's another concern. When will I find a guru? Don't worry. They say when the student is ready, when the disciple is ready, the guru comes. When you're ready. When you're ready to open your eyes, when you're ready to take off the eye mask and see the light, the guru will come. But until then, don't worry. Because there's actually a lot of gurus who have already lived. And even though having your own personal guru, who actually is going to see you and teach to you and give a mantra to you, is by far the most powerful. Until you have that, make use of all the gurus who have lived in the past and who have left teachings and legacies and so many messages. There's so many places to turn for light on our path. But that light's something everyone needs. And the reason you know that is, wherever you are on the path, we all still have our egos. And the ego is the cause of that darkness. It's the ego who says, keep your eyes closed. It's the ego who says, keep the eye mask on. This is reality. That whole light thing, it's just a myth. This is real. What I'm telling you is real. I know the truth. Look, I'm your best friend. I've been with you your whole life. Who's he? Who's she? They've just shown up. I know the truth. You are your history. You are that stuff that's happened. You are anger. You are pain. You are misery. You are your shortcomings. I know you. I've been living with you for decades. I'm your best friend. That's the game the ego plays. And that's where we need the light. Because otherwise the ego just runs the show and convinces us that the inside of our own eyelids is the truth of our existence. And so we need the one to bring the light, to show us the light.
This is OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
The number one reason girls drop out of school in sub-Saharan Africa is lack of access to feminine hygiene products. The Pads for Schoolgirls Project, an outreach of Humanity Healing International, is changing this paradigm by setting up sewing programs at schools, teaching girls a vocational skill, while producing the reusable pads that help keep them attending classes. The girls pay it forward by making and giving pad kits to other girls in need. To learn more, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
When I broke my foot.
For leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom, for taking you to your therapies, for understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. That's why AARP gives you the information to provide even better care for your loved one. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati, and thanks for coming back and joining us for more of inspiration and transformation to talk about privilege and responsibility. So sometimes we talk about our privileges, and then other times we talk about responsibilities. And how do we uphold both of them with balance and with commitment? So our privileges, when we think about it on a deep level, I mean, privileges on a superficial level is not the stuff that satsang is made of. That's what we get in our workplaces, or what we get in society, or that which, you know, money or our status in society gets us. Okay. We all know that in society, in the workplace, money buys things, status buys things. So you're going to end up, if you're the CEO of a company, for example, you've got more perks than the guy who works in the mailroom. We know that. That's not the spiritual aspect of satsang. When we think about privileges on a spiritual level, well, being alive is a privilege. All of that which we've been given is a privilege. And this is where gratitude plays such an important role on a spiritual path, is if I think I'm entitled to something, because entitlement, of course, is the flip side of that. If I'm entitled to it, I don't see it as a privilege. I see it as my right. So the minute that I start to feel entitled to things is the minute that I lose gratitude. And the minute I lose gratitude is the minute that I lose the key to my connection to God and to joy. Gratitude is something that so many of the spiritual teachings, spiritual teachers, spiritual lineages emphasize. This practice of gratitude. Because for so many of us, it's always about what's wrong. Lost this money in the stock market. This happened at work. This is aching on my body. This is where a member of my family is annoying me. This is the traffic I got stuck in. This is what's happening to my mortgage. And when we shift out of complaining into gratitude, it takes us from the stuff of our drama into the truth. And so recognizing that life is a privilege is the beginning of our gratitude. So privilege, everything is a privilege. I mean, has anybody here worked for their breath? Anybody here worked for the water we drink? Worked for the fact that you wake up in the morning? I mean, have you done something in your sleep that made you so worthy to be awakened in the morning? That the universe just knew it couldn't live without you? There's nothing that any of us does that is so crucial that the universe couldn't live without us. That we've earned our morning awakening. There's nothing that any of us has done that has earned our breath, earned our water. It's a privilege. It's a privilege of the divine. There's a beautiful, beautiful poem by Khalil Gibran that speaks about giving. And he talks about how important it is, for us to give to others, to serve others. But he says a beautiful line. He says, and I'm going to paraphrase it, I don't remember exactly, but he says, we judge those we're giving to. This person's worthy, that person's not worthy, I should serve this one, not that one. This one deserves what I'm giving, this one doesn't deserve it. And he says, thou judge, we judge, but we should not judge, because anyone who has been deemed worthy of their days and their nights by God is certainly worthy of whatever it is we have to give them. What do we have to offer someone? A few dollars, a few rupees, a hand across the street, hot meal, little bit of help, little bit of advice. What do we have to offer that's on any level as the days and the nights that the universe has already offered this person? And he says, anyone who the universe has deemed worthy of their days and their nights surely is worthy of whatever you have to give them. So our days and our nights are a privilege. There's nothing we've done to earn them. And when we really start realizing how much is a privilege, it does two things. First of all, it automatically brings in gratitude. The minute we realize, God, I haven't done anything. I'm just here. I mean, I do my best. Yeah, I'm nice to people. Try to help out. Try to give back. But there's nothing I've done on the scale of earning my breath, earning my days and nights, earning being awakened in the morning. That's a gift. And so it awakens gratitude in us. Yeah, the store was still out of our favorite brand of cereal. Yeah, our colleagues still annoyed us. Our boss still yelled at us. There was still traffic. The dishwasher still broke. The plumber didn't show up. But it takes us out of that stuff into the real, real gratitude. And then it does what the question brings us back to, privilege and responsibility, is it makes us realize what a responsibility we have. Because when we realize how much we've been given without having earned it, it awakens in us gratitude and responsibility of, wow, all this for doing nothing. All this for just being here. And that too with my ego, that too with my desires, that too with my negativity, that too with all the minutes I waste. And God is so great. God never says, well, you wasted last breath. I'm not going to give you another one. Look at you in the bar. Look at you in the club. Look at you gossiping. Look at you stealing. Look at you lying. Look at you cheating on your spouse. Forget it. I'm not going to give you another breath. You clearly don't see the value of it. Forget it. God never says that. Just keeps giving us a breath after a breath, a morning after a morning, a day after a day, a night after a night. And when we really recognize that on a deep level, it inspires responsibility. Of, okay, if I've been given so much that I didn't do anything to deserve, what's my responsibility back to God, back to the divine, humanity, the universe, whatever we understand as that capital P planner of it all. And then we start to live with that sense of responsibility. We don't take things for granted. It's not a burden, then it's a joy. Because we're living with an awareness of what a gift our life is. So rather than wasting the breaths, wasting the days, wasting the nights, we honor them, we love them, and we want to get as much as we can out of them, to utilize them the best that we can. So that's where our privilege and responsibility, you know, the question said privilege and responsibility, but it's actually a three-sided coin. It's privilege, gratitude, and responsibility. So all three of those go together. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week, and I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio. Thank you.
Thank you.